you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, the release of The Hunt was canceled last year after the film was attacked by conservative commentators. Now the movie is coming out, and its screenwriters want it known what The Hunt is not about.
The hunters in our movie are not hunting for sport. They're hunting for revenge. In fact, they're so bad at hunting that sport is the furthest thing from their minds.
And the director of the new Pixar film Onward talks about the personal loss that inspired his movie. That's today on The Frame. We'll be right back.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. As the coronavirus spreads, the entertainment industry is canceling and postponing festivals, conferences, concerts, events, and movies. The American Film Institute just put off its Lifetime Achievement Award ceremony for Julie Andrews, and the distributors of My Spy pushed the release of that family comedy from this Friday to mid-April. But there's another movie that was put on the shelf for nothing to do with a global epidemic. It's a darkly comic satire called The Hunt, and it's still set to open this Friday. Last year, Universal Pictures postponed the movie's release after the film was attacked by conservative commentators. It's about liberal elites who quote NPR, that's an actual joke in the film, hunting so-called deplorables for revenge. But by no means is The Hunt some anti-Trump polemic. The movie was written by Damon Lindelof and Nick Hughes, and when they came to our studio today, we started with any worries they might have about the movie's opening as the coronavirus is spreading. Here's Nick Hughes.
I think my first concern is for everyone's health and safety. I mean, they should make a decision based on that entirely. And if they feel that it is safe and healthy to go see our movie, I would love for them to see it. But
yeah, I don't think that we've tipped yet into that zone of people aren't going to movies or people aren't going to sporting events. Obviously, things have been canceled as a precautionary measure. But I think that until we hear otherwise, obviously, listen to what the federal government is telling you to do and trust your own instincts. And like, God forbid we find ourselves in a situation 2 weeks from now where we all realize that this outbreak had gotten way out of control and we just didn't know it yet. And it was spreading in movie theaters and a variety of other public places. It's just a movie, and I don't want to make light of it. I don't want to tell a joke right now, but I will say, like, if the movie flops this weekend, at least we can blame coronavirus. Like, you know, like it might've flopped anyway, but now we can say like, oh man, coronavirus, like that will certainly be the spin. So You have to understand, and I think you do, because we normally wouldn't be sitting here talking to you about a movie like this, that this movie, the fact that it is being released, that it has a wide release, is a miracle in and of itself. And I never thought this day would come, and I certainly never thought it would come in the midst of a pandemic. But, you know, it doesn't lessen my appreciation for the fact that it is going to be exhibited.
So let's go back. This film was going to come out in September. It's coming out now. But let's go back even beyond that, about the first ideas that you guys had for this story. What was going on in the country? What were your initial conversations before you started writing?
Yeah, I mean, well, I think it really did start for us with all the other non-political aspects. It started with, like, what would we sort of be excited to do next? And a Blumhouse movie was something that Damon mentioned in that first conversation. And he also mentioned the idea of The Most Dangerous Game and that being a framework that would be fun to sort of work in. But I think Damon said something very smart, which was that if you're going to have a premise of people hunting people, you have to sort of have a really good reason for the hunting to be taking place. And that's sort of where we started. So it was about what's the best reason for a story to be told in this genre.
And then I think on a parallel track to that conversation, we were working on The Leftovers, and that show was about getting people to believe in things. And through a slightly sort of religious construct, but then as the show kind of went on, it started to flirt more with this idea of conspiracy thinking and belief as a coping mechanism for emotional problems. And then I think that, like, then Pizzagate happened, and we started watching, like, YouTube documentaries like Loose Change about the 9/11 attacks. And
that
then,
it was a government plot, that it wasn't a terrorist attack.
Right. And then around all that, the Sandy Hook, Newtown conspiracy theory involving crisis actors. And you sort of went, like, this is horrific and sickening, but there's also, like, an emotional thing happening here where people will believe in these crazy constructs because it's more comfortable for them to believe that there's a cabal pulling the strings of society than that chaotic and scary things sometimes happen outside of our control. And then the most dangerous game is the premise is that the hunter is hunting human beings for sport. We had to eliminate the for sport aspect of it. And I think that this is where the problem began with how the movie got misinterpreted, which is the hunters in our movie are not hunting for sport. They're hunting for revenge. In fact, they're so bad at hunting that sport is the furthest thing from their minds. And so once you realize that revenge is a very powerful motivator, what is it they're trying to get revenge for? And then that led us down the rabbit hole of the idea of you have misunderstood my political ideology. You have called me a monster. I'm not a monster. Oh, well, if you're calling me a monster, I might as well just be one.
But what you're describing is a very nuanced way of looking at the story, that if you don't know what the film is about and you don't understand what you're trying to do with satire, you can completely and totally misinterpret this film.
Well, John, we all know that the one driver for box office are the words nuance and satire. I mean, like, that's a bullseye, isn't it?
Yes, and that's exactly what happens. Let's listen to this segment from Fox News.
Now, The Hollywood Reporter had previously said the original title of The Hunt was Red State versus Blue State, and that early in the script, one of the characters says, quote, nothing better than going out to the manor and slaughtering a dozen deplorables. That, of course, is the same word Hillary Clinton famously used to describe Donald Trump supporters during the 2016 presidential election campaign. We have not seen the movie nor read the screenplay, so we can't independently confirm that line about deplorables is in the movie.
We're talking with Damon Lindelof and Nick Hughes. They're the writers of the new movie, The Hunt. Damon, you were shaking your head listening to that. What does that memory bring back?
One of the misreported facts that came out in the original swirl of reporting around this movie was that the movie was called Red State, Blue State. And it never was. And I'm just, yeah, every time I hear it, I shake my head, not because it's not factual, but because it's just a bad title for a movie. But I don't know where Red State, Blue State came from. And I just, that's why I was shaking my head. I also just sort of love the idea of, like, we have not seen the movie, we have not read the script, but we're just going to report the most, like, sort of volatile, divisive elements of it and just say the word deplorables 9 times.
What is it like to watch this play out in real time where it, at one point, it's maybe funny and kind of crazy, no such thing as bad publicity, and then it's like, this is a crisis, and there's problems, and Universal is calling.
I think we are here to tell you, John, that there is such a thing as bad publicity.
It was surreal, and I think the frustrating part was just that there was people who had very strong opinions who hadn't seen the movie yet.
Coming up on The Frame, more of my conversation with Damon Lindelof and Nick Hughes, the co-writers of the new movie, The Hunt.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. one lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win, and the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Let's get back now to my conversation with Damon Lindelof and Nick Cues. They're the screenwriters of the new movie, The Hunt. The violent comedic satire was going to be released last September, but after negative attention in the media around its premise and following two mass shootings, Universal put the film on the shelf. Here's Damon Lindelof.
The horrific events that happened in El Paso and Dayton, they were back to back. So everybody sort of woke up on Saturday morning to hear about the El Paso shootings, which was the shooter walked into a Walmart and kind of opened fire. And it was later revealed that he had written some sort of anti-immigration manifesto. And then late that same night into the early morning on Sunday, the Dayton shooter walked into a bar and open fire also with an automatic weapon. And of course, at that point, it was August, and we were still about 6 weeks away from release. And there were conversations happening about how appropriate our advertising was. And then by Friday of that week, Nick and I received the phone call that the release date was being canceled.
Nick, I'm going to play you the new trailer for the film, and then we'll talk about how the film is being repositioned.
You actually believed we were hunting human beings for sport. But you are.
We have an opportunity here to teach these people. These are not real people. They're actors.
I'm playing an Arab refugee, but I identify as white. I think that's problematic too, in some way.
You wanted it to be real, so you decided it was.
And we should say that's dialogue from the film. You didn't re-record or retrack anything, did you?
No, the movie is exactly the same as it was before. We did not change anything, nor were we asked to change anything.
We made it a little louder.
But, turned it up.
But that new spot is basically saying what you thought was so wrong, and we don't even need to change dialogue because it's in the movie anyway.
The idea that of judging a book by its cover is very much sort of a recurring theme in the movie itself. And so when that, in fact, happened to the movie, we did think that we were onto something.
Nick, how fun was it to write jokes about the people that you spend time with? There are jokes about NPR. There are jokes about Ava DuVernay and her social media. There's assumptions that maybe certain people have about conservatives not reading Orwell. How much did you enjoy putting those lines in to poke fun at the people that you hang out with?
Before Nick answers, I just have to say every single thing that you mentioned on the list was a Nick idea, like intuitively, like every otherwise known as the best.
I know your sense of humor.
But otherwise known as the best jokes in the movie. Yes,
it was extremely enjoyable for sure. I mean, it feels like not even people that I spend time with, but myself. You know, that felt like some of the best experience in the writing process. And it did feel like that, you know, it was exciting to try to just go for that level of specificity. We were going after ourselves as much as possible.
I think the hardest challenge in the movie was to heighten it to a level that seemed absurd.
Yeah.
You know, where it's sort of like, I don't think we've gone far enough. Like, I think I literally say that all the time. Like, how do we make it clear to people that we are, this is a satire?
Do you think all of this points out A, how difficult it is to do satire, and B, how difficult it is to do satire in an era where people can misconstrue and misinterpret and jump to conclusions with absolutely no information?
Yes to all of the above. I mean, the thing that makes me feel, to be honest with you, kind of dumb, or at the very least naive, is that I can honestly tell you, and I can't speak for Nick, but I think that we at least shared this as it was happening. We were very surprised when what happened. In hindsight, it seems like that's an unbelievable concept.
Is
like you made a you made a movie with the word deplorables in it, and people are identifying in these camps. But we sent this script out to 50 different people, and then we made this movie in rural Louisiana. And to say that there were members of our crew and plenty of people who read the script from all walks of life and all political ideologies, and it was a very intimate family. At some point, someone would have come up to us and said, "You got a real hot potato here," like, or, "I have to be honest with you, your movie's kind of offensive." And all we ever heard was like, "We think it's funny," or it's like, it's time that somebody like, but it's like, if you're trying to explain a Saturday Night Live sketch, it may seem super duper offensive, but if you just watch the sketch, it's like, it's either funny or it's not funny. But I think the idea to say like, "Oh, Saturday Night Live did a sketch this past Saturday about coronavirus, and it's a soap opera where Daniel Craig, where the whole joke is people can't touch one another," you might be inclined to say, "My God, people are dying of coronavirus. There are people on a cruise ship right now who are fighting for their lives, and Daniel Craig has the audacity to make fun of coronavirus." And it's like, but yes, like, this is how we tell stories. This is how we process things in television and movies. And the idea that a movie can be dangerous was just outside of my realm of understanding. I know that it seems ridiculous, but it is true.
I'm going to switch gears completely. Nick, I want to ask you about a project you're developing, Station 11. This is an adaptation of the great novel by Emily St. John Mandel about a global flu pandemic that has wiped out, I think, 99% of the Earth's population. And it's about a group of artists who are traveling around, performing, trying to bring some hope into the world. And even though it's not going to come out probably for a while, as you think about the role that art can play in these times, how would you categorize Station 11 and what it has to say about how we survive and how we deal with a public health crisis?
Well, I think Emily herself said it best in when she put it in the words of the slogan of the Shakespeare troupe that we're following, which is "survival is insufficient," which I think is a really beautiful sentiment.
And by the way, that's not a Shakespeare line. That's from Star Trek Voyager.
Yes.
That line is.
Yes. But yeah, it's definitely a very surreal now, again, that this is sort of timing up with a pandemic. The thing that is cool about Station 11 is you do really get into what it would actually be like for a normal person to just be going about their lives as this flu was spreading. And a lot of the feelings that Damon was talking about earlier and we were talking about earlier are very much in the material. In terms of like how to know when it's real, you know, like how to know, like there's a great scene in the book where Jeevan is just going to the grocery store because his sister works at a hospital and
paramedic who is also a paparazzi.
Yeah. And he's been told that this is happening. And so he's at this grocery store loading up cart after cart with groceries. And everyone else is still looking at him being like, it's in that amazing space of like, right, if you know ahead of time before everyone else, you're crazy.
Right, because a doctor has told him it's worse than you think.
Yeah.
Damon Lindelof and Nick Hughes are the writers of the movie The Hunt. Nick and Damon, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
The Hunt opens in theaters on March 13th. Coming up on The Frame, how the director of the new Pixar movie Onward was inspired by the death of his own father.
Hi, I'm Tracy Thomas, host of One for the Books, and we are back for another round.
This is clearly an NPR audience.
Yeah, I think they're so smart. What the hell?
My guests this time are actor Vella Lavelle and author Amanda Montell, whose new book, The Age of Magical Overthinking, is out now. Join us on May 15th at the Crawford Family Forum for book talk, trivia, and hot takes. Tickets can be found at laist.com/events.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Pixar's latest release, Onward, opened the weekend with about $40 million at the box office. Directed and co-written by Dan Scanlon, the film follows two teenage brothers, voiced by Tom Holland and Chris Pratt. They're elves who live in a world where magic has been replaced by technology and modern convenience. Here they are, trying out a spell.
Here we go. Focus.
Something wrong?
Sorry, it's just your stance is, here. Chin up, elbows out, feet apart, back slightly arched. Okay, how's that feel?
Great.
The boy's father died when they were young, so young, in fact, that they don't remember him. But they have a chance to meet him again for one day if they can get the magic right. It's a story that mirrors Scanlon's own life.
My father, William Scanlon III, my brother is the fourth, he passed away in 1977 when I was probably about 16 or 18 months old. And my brother was 3 at the time. And we don't remember him at all. We've got, you know, old home movies. They don't have sound. You know, it's not much to glean of who he is. And we've always wondered who he was and how we would grow up to be like him.
And is your mom still around? Were you able to ask her questions?
Yeah, my mom is wonderful. My mom raised us. My mom was our support, our inspiration, our protector. I mean, she was everything to us. And we asked a lot of questions about him. And everything we knew, all the pieces of him, really most of them came from her. And during making this project, I talked to my mom a lot. And I asked her a lot of questions. And I found out things I wouldn't have known if I hadn't started this project. You know, I found out that one of my first words was dad, and that my dad heard me call him dad, and that I called my father dad, something I thought I had never done. My mom even went out to old friends of my father and had them write letters to my brother and I telling us what my dad was like. So really, really wonderful personal things came out of the process of this.
And for the characters in your story, Ian and Barley, I think part of the central premise of the film is that your parent, even though you're not aware of his or her presence, is always there beside you in some way, shape, or form, that they have made you become the person you are to some degree. As a filmmaker, did you feel that in this process?
Yeah, you know, I think so much of the film is also about defining parent, you know, defining who that person is who helped you become who you are. Sometimes it's a friend or a teacher. I mean, we have them all around us, and the movie is really a celebration of them. But to answer your question, as far as having my father there, probably in ways I'll never know. He's in my DNA. I behave like him, I'm guessing. We found an audio cassette when we were teenagers that had my father's voice on it. And when we played it, all he said was hello and goodbye. When asked to say something into the tape recorder, he said, hi, in this very nervous, awkward way. And then when they said, well, say something other than that, he said, bye, in this very shy way. And I thought, oh, he's an introvert like me. And, you know, in a way that was disappointing, I think, oh, that's not my best quality. So I do think they're there, you know, they're there in you and they're having that experience with you and in a wonderful way.
When did you first start thinking about making a movie that was inspired by your father and missing him?
This story has always been one of the defining stories of my life. I mean, it's just a fact of my life, having lost my dad. And it wasn't until really talking it through with other filmmakers at the studio that really worked as kind of art therapists that I started to see that there could be a story there. I talked to my mom a lot, as I mentioned earlier, and she said at one point when I was telling her that I hadn't had a lot of sad things happen in my life, and that a lot of times movies come from some sort of sad or fearful place, even funny movies. And she said, well, how can you say you didn't have anything sad happen? Your father died. And I said, well, that's not really sad because I didn't remember him. I don't know him, so it's not really sad. And she said, that's why it's sad. And in that moment, I thought, wow, yeah, I mean, when you lose someone you know, you feel grief, but grief is really just a byproduct of love. But when you don't even have grief, it means you didn't have love. It means you really missed something. And that's a very abstract and kind of intellectual emotion and feeling, but it was pretty crazy to talk through and think about.
We're talking with Dan Scanlon. He's the director and co-writer of Pixar's new movie, Onward. I'm going to give you a list of movies. The connection is not that they're all Walt Disney Company movies. You can stop me when you spot a trend. Lilo and Stitch, Bambi, Dumbo, Peter Pan, Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Guessing probably dead parents.
Dead or missing parents or evil step-parents.
Yeah.
So that is part of popular culture. And obviously there's part of Onward that fits into that cycle. What did those movies mean to you growing up?
You know, it's funny, I probably didn't really notice as much as other kids did because I did lose my parent. It felt normal to me, or I felt a connection to it. You know, maybe that is a cliche, the dead parent in one of these films, but I think it's an important one because for kids like me who have lost someone, you do feel that you're not alone. And it also does deal with some of the feelings you're having and emotions you're having. And obviously we had a deceased family member in Onward because it was this personal story. It's not a device that we added later.
You touched on something that I think is really important, and that is that word device. That if you have a device, then you can understand why somebody has an evil stepmother, why they're not with their own parents. But in your film, it's not a device. It's the beginning, middle, and end. It's what the story is about. It's not what caused the story.
Right, exactly. And even that you mentioned the step-parent, I think one thing that's unique about Onward is the step-parent isn't evil. They don't get along great right away. They're a little awkward and uncomfortable around each other. But you can kind of follow the step-parent of Officer Colt Bronco, who's the Centaur police officer. He's always doing everything he thinks is right because he loves the boy's mother. I think the movie shows a step-parent and step-kid relationship in a hopefully more nuanced way, and hopefully a way that people can kind of learn from who are in that situation.
So much of Pixar's research is about studying how things perform. It could be how a fish swims, how a slinky toy expands and contracts. What were the kinds of real-life research that you did on this film? I have to think looking at how men wear pants is important, but what else would surprise me in terms of the real-life research that went into the design of the film?
We did experiment with, you know, how legs could emote. We put green screen tights all over the upper half of ourselves and then just filmed ourselves walking around and then, you know, took the upper half off and saw how much emotion we could get with the pants. And then, you know, there's lots of just fun in trying to create Colt, the horseman. And, you know, we had our animators who were aficionados on how horses move and, you know, always trying to make it look like he was a guy riding a horse, even though he is a guy who is a horse, just trying to find that humor where we could.
What do you think your little boy self would have made of watching this film at a young age?
Oh, that's a great question that I don't think anyone has ever asked. I would have been like, wow, this is really similar to my life. I think it would have been really enlightening to see a positive brother relationship. My brother and I have been best friends our whole life. We see a lot of movies about brothers beating each other up and picking on each other, and that was never our experience. So I would have been really pleasantly shocked and surprised to see that even though these brothers are different and they have conflict, they do love each other, and there is a sensitivity to that love that I certainly wasn't seeing when I was younger, and I don't see a lot of now. It's just the male brotherly, sensitive, vulnerable love.
Dan Scanlon is the director and co-writer of Onward. Dan, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
And that'll do it for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow at the Moen Broadcast Center.
The Colorado River is running dry. Water may not reach millions of people.
So if there's no water, there's no water for everybody.
It's up to California's lead negotiator, a 28-year-old.
This is a historic thing coming.
And six other negotiators to find a solution.
I want an agreement that lessens the pain for all of us, not just some of us.
Listen to Imperfect Paradise, the Gen Z water deal maker, wherever you get podcasts.